Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Diana Johnstone, Ph.D. A native of Minnesota, raised in New Deal, Washington, Diana Johnstone has spent more than half her life in Europe as a political observer and journalist, working for Agency France-Presse for In These Times as European correspondent and as press officer for the Green Group in the European Parliament. She holds a B.A. in Russian Area Studies and a Ph.D. in French Literature. She's author of three books, including Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions, and co-author with her father, Paul Johnstone, of From Mad to Madness, Inside Pentagon, Nuclear War Planning. And her most recent book is Circle in the Darkness, Memoir of a World Watcher, which I interviewed you about a few months ago, which was a fabulous interview. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
You're very welcome.
So what I'd like to talk about today is globalization and the EU, and I would like to, by the end, have some sort of understanding of how the left has gone from being opposed to globalization to it being a litmus test for the left that if you don't, for example, support the EU, then you must be a fascist. And that has confused me for decades now. So can we start with, say, a history of the EU?
Well, yes, you're not the only one confused by that, because indeed it's very confusing. Well, you know, the history, I don't know where exactly to start, you know, because I'll be very politically incorrect and say that in a way, the European Union, you could see the beginnings of it in a Nazi-occupied Europe, because you could almost say that there was a transformation from the Pax Germanica under Nazi occupation and the Pax Americana, because some of the people are even the same in the two cases, because the Nazi occupation of Europe was presented as a way of bringing Europe together against Bolshevism, and the war against the Soviet Union was presented as a European war, and they were recruiting people into the Wehrmacht and the SS to go fight against the Soviet Union in the name of Europe. And then curiously enough, you see, the European Union began, it changed its name all the time, the European construction, or whatever you want to call it, under United States sponsorship, began more or less with the Marshall Plan, with the United States pretty much taking over the Western European economies, which had suffered tremendously, because you have to realize that in World War II, the United States came up, profited enormously from the war, came out way ahead of everybody, whereas the European countries had suffered and were in very bad shape. And so it was absolutely easy for the United States to then become the sponsor of the country, but they excluded the Soviet Union and the countries that had been liberated, occupied by the Soviet Union. But it began as a more or less your economic unity that was sponsored notably by a businessman, Jean Monnet. And you see, he's presented as the father of the European Union, one of the fathers. And it's very clear reading him that his idea of uniting Europe was above all to was above all to get rid of nations in a step toward world government. And of course, the United States sponsorship of this project always had the notion that they were going toward a sort of world government that naturally would be directed by the United States. I mean, that's just implicit in U.S. post-World War II policy. And the institutions were created first, the coal and steel industries brought together. And so behind this, initially, you had American sponsorship. And then you had the ideological argument, which was the argument that uniting Europe and getting rid of weakening nation states would bring peace. Actually, that was the same idea that the Nazis had, because they thought, you know, weaken the nations and have German peace. You know, Germany would bring peace after it won the war. So it's always, these empires are always in the name of peace. And the project was never terribly popular, except with sort of lived with a number of Catholics, in particular the Catholic parties of Europe. We're thinking of the Christian origins of European countries as a unifying idea, and various liberals. But it was sort of an elite idea of getting the, it never had much popular support. But it didn't have much the popular opposition either, because it wasn't that big an issue for a long time. And it's really been an institutional takeover, much more than a political movement. It's the institutions have grown and created this thing without ever really there being a popular impetus behind it.
So what year, when you're going through this history, what year are you up to now about, or what decade?
Well, look, in the late 40s, you had the Marshall Plan, you had the beginning of the first treaty is the Treaty of Rome, was signed in March 1957 and came into effect January 1st, 1958. That's the beginning of the European Economic Community, and that was only France, Germany, Italy, and the Benelux countries. That is to say, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg. So it was six countries, and the idea was this common market. But in fact, it very quickly, I mean, it rapidly has moved from being a common market to being an open market. And that's why I say it is going much, it didn't so much bring these countries together as it has opened up their economy, so that in fact this process has gone on and on. And of course now there are 27 members, without Britain, which came in and left. So there are now 27 members, and the institutional, it has grown in funny ways. I mean, for one way it has grown is through the European Court of Justice. That's a very interesting story. It shows just how non-democratic this is, because a court was set up when they had the, in the early 50s, for the coal and steel, just a court that would settle any kind of disputes concerning the coal and steel industry agreements. And this coal, court has taken over the, this has sort of grown into being a major decisive institution of the European construction. It's interesting that the first judges of that court, it's very, very curious because the first judges of that court were the Italian, who was the presiding judge, had been a prominent fascist in Italy. The German judge had been an outright Nazi. The advocate general had also been pretty much of a Nazi, and the French advocate general had been a high official of the Vichy government. And it's very interesting because nobody ever has noticed who these people were until some research was done recently. But it's very interesting that every now and then somebody finds some poor bloke who was at the end of the war, when he was 14 years old, was drafted into the SS and was a guard at some concentration camp, and he's put on trial, and you make a big fuss about getting rid of Nazis. But the fact is, these very top people in the fascist Nazi regimes went right straight into the European court. Nobody ever even mentioned such a thing. And this court made some of the decisions which really have created the European construction. some people call this a coup d'etat. In 1963, the court, with the help, by the way, of an American jurist who was sort of sitting there as a guest, wrote a ruling that any rules of the European Union took precedence over national law. And so this is something that was never voted by the people or even discussed. It was an obscure legal decision by this court. And then there was a second big one in 1979, the famous Cassis de Dijon ruling that ruled that any product which is on sale in any nation state can be on sale on any other in any other nation state, regardless of rules. And so these were rulings which I say some commentators call a coup d'etat, which in fact eliminated national sovereignty and establishing the superiority. Legal superiority of the European community, now European Union. And there's no court of appeal to this European court. Anybody can go to that court, and it's, of course, been equipped, being the people who are very eager to have European unity, who are never elected, who are unknown to the public. And this is a major way in which the European Union has grown to be the powerful institution it is now.
So you said that there wasn't a lot of opposition to it. Can you sort of give us a parallel history? You've done a wonderful job of a history of the Union itself, and can you give us a parallel history of whatever opposition there was to it?
Well, a lot of the left in Europe was opposed to it because in those early days, there was a left. There was a left. There were the British Labourites. There was the Communist parties, and they saw quite clearly that all of this construction was very much favorable to capitalism and not to workers' organizations and so on. It was clearly a project that was anti-national and and pro-capitalist. And then there was also there was some opposition. It was the sponsors of it came from what you call the center, this famous center, which is always there, of the conformist part of the political spectrum. And in Germany and Italy, it was especially the Christian Democratic parties, which were very powerful after the war. And in France, the centrist parties, which were somewhat Christian Democrat, but more socialist, etc. And de Gaulle was wary of this because of the national sovereignty issue. So the Gaullists and the communists, although they were opposite in many ways, on the opposite sides, were both coming out of resistance quite patriotic and quite concerned about French sovereignty and French people's capacity to make their own decisions. And so there was opposition in France from both these, not total opposition, not like saying we mustn't have anything to do with it, but let's keep it limited. And and since there was this political desire to keep it limited, that's one reason that the way it got unlimited was by legal judgments that nobody's paying any attention to. So that just sort of went right past any political opposition when the courts do these rulings. And that's why I insist that the construction was done for basically for a long time more by the court than by any political, visible political decision.
So, no. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I can elaborate on the particularities of this, but I think there are various stages in the development of this union. Maybe you should ask some questions here because.
I guess a couple of things. One of them is I would love to hear a little bit more about the stages in the development, and then I would love to hear. I guess, have there been really serious through that process? Were there any groups who were extremely serious about opposition to the EU? This is still in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And then at some point, maybe in 10 minutes or so, I would like to start a transition toward understanding the flip on the left, which in the United States, you know, the left was utterly opposed to NAFTA, to all these various so-called free trade agreements as recently as the mid-90s. And now if you oppose free trade agreements, I mean, that's going to be the nub of it when we get there in a while, is that flip on the so-called left, where they went from really being opposed to this to supporting it. And actually, another thing, before we go there, I guess what I'd really like to ask first is, can you be explicit about what these open markets do to especially small farmers, small artisans, small to small local regional local or regional businesses, or I don't want to say the word businesses, but regional, very localized, locally controlled industries. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Well, I think the situation is different in the United States from here, because the original agreement around the Treaty of Rome was a sort of deal between the French and the Germans, where they would have. Because basically, this construction has always been very helpful to German industry. And the French got the deal that they would have something that would be good for French farmers. Although the help to the farmers tends to go more to the bigger farmers. That's for sure. But the opposition of open markets is not just, I think a big problem of the European Union is its emphasis on competition. I should talk sometime about these commissioners. It's quite comic. I mean, the commission has 27 commissioners whose responsibilities are very vague and overlapping, because it has to have 27 countries. Everyone has to have a commissioner, and it's not too sure what they're for. But the problem of competition is that it attacks, in particular, public services. Now, you see, public services are really a major item in the redistribution of wealth. They're a fair type of redistribution of wealth, because if you have good public services, they're open to everybody, so they're equalizing, and that's in transport and communications and so on. And an aspect of the obsession with competition in the European Union, which I think you have also, it's capitalism, is to say that you must have competition for public services, so that they can, the state cannot have a monopoly. You have to open them up. And this, in fact, has very complicating, it tends to raise the prices of things, contrary to the idea that it make it cheaper. It tends to cause complications. If you have the railroads and they're competing, somebody's in charge of keeping the tracks, and then you have them competing with each other, and it tends actually to weaken public services and privatize them. It tends to go in those directions. And then, of course, the opening to competition it isn't even the little ones that suffer, it's the big ones. It's the case of, well, this is fairly, it is Alstom, which is a major in French industry, which was put under pressure from the United States government, and then purchased by General Electric, which takes a good part of French energy independence outside of French control. So you're also denationalizing by this competition business, and it's not just other Europeans that buy. It's the Chinese or Americans or anybody can, because the market is so open and so much on the rules of competition that you're a nation loses control of its most basic functions through this.
And I remember in my early 20s suddenly understanding that as a major problem of globalization. If you care about, for example, national security, and I suddenly understood the importance of, for example, having local control or regional control or national control over, for example, national food systems, and not having that controlled by some economic entity. Oh, here's an example. Is in the United States, a lot of mining on public lands is done by foreign companies. And so foreign companies are destroying the desert of Nevada, for example. And the same thing will happen in Bolivia with companies from Japan or the United States. And that, you know, as much as I think it's horrible to destroy the desert of Nevada, I think it makes it even worse when it's done for those who have absolutely no stake in the local economy or the local. It's just colonialism again.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's now you're getting to that is exactly the point, because this whole the whole ideology has been built up. And when I say ideology is built up, you say, well, who does it? Well, I'll tell you who does it. You know, the West is absorbs an enormous, you could say, entertainment industry, which is also an ideological industry. And they preach certain things. You know, they preach that immigrants are good and that, you know, that borders are bad and nationalism is terrible, etc. But here's the point. I mean, it used to be when you cared about your country or your land, you wanted to defend. We don't want war, but if necessary, we'll defend our territory, our borders, right? Our territory that we care about. Now, the idea is we defend our values, and our values are anywhere. They're in Syria. They're in China. We may have to have war to protect our values absolutely anywhere, but we're not protecting our territory, our country anymore. That is wide open. And it's true that, you know, people who live there and who can care about the environment, about the surroundings, more than some multinational mining company that comes in. That's just in the nature of things. So this anti-nationalism is extremely good for international capitalism, international finance, and it cares nothing at all about people there where they live. In fact, if things get bad, they're supposed to go somewhere else.
And how has that and at one point that was let me know if I'm incorrect. At one point that was a not only a local position, but that was also not infrequently a leftist position, because it was the capitalists who wanted the open access to everything and the open access to labor moving in to drive down local labor prices. And can you talk about that transformation of the left, if I have it correct, from opposing this to supporting it?
Absolutely, because I remember, in fact, when I started to work for the European Greens in 89, I remember having meetings, in fact, of Greens. They've changed completely. Where precisely you were concerned, environmentalism was also on the left, because you were concerned about people living where they were and their environments being destroyed, etc. And now that's completely gone. And you see, I think there's been this huge ideological shift, which is not just spontaneous, because it's very much encouraged by show business and the entertainment industry and all of the rest of it. You see, back after the Vietnam War, and you're concerned about the third world people, the third world people being liberated in their own countries and building their own countries. And in Asia, that is somewhat happening, actually. But this attitude, the attitude that now prevails, is not thinking of the third world as a place to be liberated where the people can improve their lot, etc., but as some kind of hellhole where the people have to run away and come to Europe or the United States, which is terrible for both ends, because it's really making, you're making the poor countries dependent on international money orders. That's what it comes down to. I mean, this thing about encouraging immigration, for instance, from poor countries, is saying, well, please send us your strongest young men so that they can earn low wages and send money orders back to the people living in misery back in their own country, instead of building their own country. You see, this is the kind of late colonialist attitude that the best thing we can do for a poor country is to take in their most vigorous people.
And can we you've mentioned this a few times. Can you catalog how it went from the understanding that there was before on the left, especially, to I'm really interested in how we got to today, where if you, okay, I know a fair number of leftists / liberals. I know those two different things in the UK, for example, who for years I have wanted to simply have this conversation with them and understand, because I just don't understand it. And I want to understand why, if you say the word Brexit to them, they will call you a Nazi and hang up on you. And well, as opposed to simply having a conversation, I can't even ask them, so why is Brexit a right-wing thing? I can't even ask that question without them yelling at me.
No, I mean, I can't answer that, but because people are getting to be like that on a lot of subjects, and it's becoming really very difficult to discuss certain subjects, because there's this new moral order that is asserting itself. And then either you think that the nation state is terrible and borders should be open and this and that, or else you're a horrible fascist. And I guess people in this age of uncertainty find some security in this simple code of what is right and wrong, and they can be adhere to the right ideas and condemn all those who have them wrong. But I mean, this is a kind of moral and intellectual degeneration which I find most deplorable. But it differs in different countries. I mean, in France, because after all, I live mainly in France. In France, it has something to do with hostility to the Communist Party. Around May 68, after May 68, there's just a whole lot of intellectual resentment against the Communist Party, which was a real working class party, by the way, which they're not always. But the French Communist Party was really the party of the working class. And it was opposed to mass immigration. I mean, of course, there are always some in there. The party was very good at assimilating immigrants from various countries by enlisting them in the workers' cause, if you want. I mean, it was a great instrument of assimilation and integration. And it was very weakened really precisely by the common program government failing in the 80s. So the thing is that when the Mitterrand government came in with a with a pretty fairly socialist program, and then abandoned that program. The first who suffered was the Communist Party, because people felt betrayed or lost or something. And that's when the socialists, because they were abandoning the working class part of their program, became very heavy on anti-racism. And they redefined the left as anti-racism, since it was no longer socialism, no longer having nationalized industries and social measures and so on, as their program had been. They suddenly decided that anti-racism was the cause of the left. And when you, and that goes very quickly then to considering that opposition to massive immigration must be racist, when it isn't at all. Because I can tell you that in a lot of neighborhoods in France, you will find people who are most hostile to massive immigration are immigrants, because they think that having more people coming is going to be, they're going to be suffer from it the first and the most. So, but you considering that opposition to that, any concern for your own country is racist, for your own people, for your own country is racist. Then you get this kind of abstract moralism of you're only good if you're concerned about other people who somewhere else, but if you're concerned about your own people, you must be bad. This is devastating, and it is a major reason. It is a major reason that the left is just collapsing politically everywhere, because this does not attract people.
Excuse me. I'm thinking about what you were saying earlier about one of the things you've said that I've absolutely loved today is this how the whole open border question really has been a transfer of the understanding that those at the center of empire should not be destroying the homelands of the people who are in essentially the colonies. It's a tacit acceptance of that primary damage, which causes them then to flee their own country. And I'm thinking about the opposition to NAFTA part of the opposition to NAFTA was that everybody knew it would destroy subsistence farmers, in the massive influx of corn from Iowa would destroy subsistence farmers in Mexico, which is precisely what it did.
Exactly. You know, I thought about that. I visited Mexico very, very long ago, and I was just fascinated by it's a big country, and you have really distinctive cultures from one place to another, you know, and this free trade stuff just destroys that. It ruins all of these sort of more or less semi-independent cultures that flourish and have their own economy and cultures and so on. And instead, you have these big crops coming in, and it completely just wrecks the way of life. And it does in both directions. So, I think it should be an absolute law that, you know, you start out, you produce what you need, and if there's something left over, trade it, right? But you don't start with the idea that what you're making things in order to trade. You see, that's completely backwards, and that's the ideology that's been imposed. You know, you produce stuff in order to sell it somewhere else, and maybe there's nothing any left for you at the end, or not enough. So the whole globalization thing is screwed up.
So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and I'm wondering if you can talk. Okay, so I've been having some conversations with some people in various parts of, especially Eastern Europe, who they're kind of conservative, but they're certainly not, you know, Nazis. They're not fascists. They're fairly conservative, but we have wonderful conversations. And these people are very strongly opposed to the EU because of what it does to national sovereignty and what it does to local culture. And can you talk about the spectrum of the state and spectrum of current resistance to the EU going from the, I mean, including the people who would be classified as neo-Nazi and including people who would be sort of right-wing and including whatever opposition there is on the left?
Well, I don't like the category about Nazis because or fascists or this or that because except in certain places like Ukraine where there are open Nazis, you really don't find that much around anymore. That's a historic phenomenon that is belongs to the past. But you have a lot of conservatism in Eastern Europe. But you have a lot of aggressive leftism of the cultural type coming from the West. It's sort of there's this new sort of aggressive wokeness that is going to be the latest excuse for us to change the world because we've got to make everybody as woke as we are. And in Eastern European countries, they tend not to be. But the difficulty is, of course, the Eastern European countries were subjected to Soviet domination. They don't like the idea of having the domination from the West, but on the other hand, there's the money. And the thing is that there is money that flows to these new countries to Italy. I could talk to you about Italy just now. It's amazing what's happening in Italy because it was very, very strong opposition to the European Union growing in Italy. We could almost say that that's the country where opposition to the European Union would come to a boil because Italy suffers a great deal from being in the euro since the currency does not suit their economy and so on. But now, right now, all of the parties have united to put in charge Mario Draghi, who is a world-class banker who's everywhere from Goldman Sachs to the European Central Bank and are completely surrendering to him because the European Union is attributing a big hunk of money to go for recovery and resilience funds, which in fact, so all of the politicians want to be there. In fact, the right wing Salvini, who'd been very anti-Europe, suddenly says, I want to be in the room when the money is dished out. He said that. And so they're all gathering around because there's money coming in. And that money is going to be directed toward development of digital economy, artificial intelligence, and the military. That's the way it's going. I mean, this is a huge subject and I can't go through it tonight, but I mean to say that the principles are one thing and then in comes the money. And the principles suddenly just vanish.
So thank you for that. And how do you see, I know that the crystal ball is always cloudy, but how do you see the EU playing out over the next 10 or 15 years? Do you see there being more countries leave, or do you see it strengthening its centralized power, or what do you see?
Well, it doesn't really. I mean, neither one. For one thing, you have to realize that Britain leaving is not a good test case for anybody else, because in a sense, Britain was never in. The British were always hostile to the European Union. When they were in for opportunistic reasons, they never really believed in it. They don't like having all the rules. And the real reason, I mean, the real opposition to the European Union in Britain is quite simple and democratic. They are used to having their own parliament decide for them, and they don't like having Brussels decide for them. It's very, very simple. It doesn't take any fascist tendencies or even anything to do with immigration. The British have never liked having Brussels set the rules for them. So that the fact that they left is really an expression of the British national character. But other countries don't have the same history, and it's not easy to get out. There are quite a number of politicians in France who would like to get out, but they are isolated. They rival with each other, and you don't have any kind of consistent movement. That's the problem. So, on the other hand, Europe is not really strengthening. It's not doing well with Europe. It's not doing well with the economy. The peace is a farce, because there now is going toward more military confrontation with Russia. It was never for peace, because they bombed Yugoslavia and Libya and so on. So the peace thing is an illusion. The prosperity has not been arrived at. So it is really not succeeding. But on the other hand, you have countries all bound together in various ways, and getting out is not so easy. So I really don't. I'm not one to predict even things that are a lot simpler than that.
So I guess I have two more questions. One of them is, so I have a friend, a good friend from Romania, who grew up back when it was communist. And she said that the communist regime was really horrible and hated. And she said that the collapse of the communist regime and the westernization of Romania has also, both of these are true, has also been a complete disaster. And the forests where the environmental destruction has really increased. The people she knows, at least, the way she puts it is, they were unhappy before, and now they feel even less happy. And I have spoken with some other people from Eastern Europe, and that has also been the case, that they feel like there's been a lot of colonialism from the West.
Yeah, well, that's right. Of course, it varies from country to country. I mean, these countries are not all the same. And Romania had, a particularly unpopular government. You go to East Germany and it's quite different, though there are a lot of people who are nostalgic for East Germany, because they were much better off. But East Germany was a much better place to live than Romania, and so on. There is in fact, you see, there is not this growth of a European people. There is a growth, in fact. You put people together, and the more you put them together, the more they begin to dislike each other. There's tremendous hostility that has developed between Greeks and Germans because of the economic difficulties. In fact, the malfunctioning of the European Union tends, unfortunately, to take the form of more or less unfriendly feelings toward other nationalities. I mean, that's what happened in Yugoslavia. What happened in Yugoslavia was the country got terribly in debt because of the oil crisis. And then each republic, because Yugoslavia was divided into these states, but each one wanted to blame the others. And so when you have this problem of entities grouped together, when something goes wrong, they tend to turn against each other rather than coming together.
Well, thank you so much for this entire conversation. Thank you so much for your work in the world. And you've helped me to gain more tools to try to understand this whole question that has baffled me for decades about left support for the EU. Thank you so much for that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Diana Johnstone. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Well, thank you very much, Derek. I wish you well.